Well, we are so close to the end, really, of the 2020 Formula One season that most of the teams, it sounds like, obviously, now that both championships are over, most of looking at the contenders for next season turns to just that, turns to next season, because the last three races of this year, pretty much for pride. I mean, teams, obviously, for the money aspect of it, want to finish as high in the standings as they can, and there's still an interesting midfield battle going on. But for the most part, it's about trying to put the remaining pieces into place for next season. And we know that one of the couple seats still available is going to be taken by Lewis Hamilton. That's the seat at Mercedes. Because right now, Valtteri Bottas still the only driver confirmed for Mercedes next year. But the talk, everything up to this point has led us to believe that Lewis Hamilton is coming back next season. And why wouldn't he? When he has been unstoppable the last 4 years, but really six of the last seven. Because he was dominant in 2016 as well, but that championship went to Nico Rosberg, so we're not going to, you know, give him full credit for that season. But essentially, the other 6 years that Mercedes has been dominating, Lewis Hamilton has been leading the charge. So obviously no surprise that he is going to take that seat and be Valtteri Bottas' teammate for next season as well. But there are still some, well, and I would say that the other seat that still says to be announced, but I think we all know who's going to take it, and that's going to be Lance Stroll with Aston Martin, Racing Point becoming Aston Martin for next year. Sebastian Vettel coming onto that team, taking what was Sergio Perez's seat, so I think it's all but a formality that that Lance Stroll, since his dad, Lawrence Stroll, essentially owns the team. I would imagine that Lance is going to be driving for Aston Martin next year because his dad invested in Williams, and Lance Stroll raced for Williams. Then his dad took his money out of there, put it in Racing Point, so Lance Stroll came over to Racing Point. Now the team essentially just being rebranded from Racing Point to Aston Martin. I imagine Sebastian Vettel's teammate will be Lance Stroll. So really what that does is it leaves open four seats still to be filled for next year. And now that none of the teams have to worry about a championship charge, essentially, because both of those championships have been decided, they can really start to focus their attention on that driver lineup for next year. We're still waiting to hear who is going to be Pierre Gasly's teammate at AlphaTauri. I think it could be Daniel Kvyat, or it could be Alexander Albon, because I have a feeling that Albon's not coming back to Red Bull next year. Now, he very well could, because he's had an okay performance in the last few races, but again, you look at his whole season's worth of work, and it just has not been up to the standards that Red Bull need to be competing with Mercedes. When Mercedes is going first, second, or second, third, or even if it's third, fourth, even though it's not really what they do anymore, it's usually first, second, or second, third, or first, third. You need your second driver to be up there. Verstappen's doing all he can. If he's finishing races, he's on the podium this year. Alexander Albon needs to be in that same space. He needs to be up in the top five, essentially as the other driver in the top four to make it a Mercedes-Red Bull battle, because that was the only team that had a chance to beat Mercedes this year, and they just didn't. And again, that's not necessarily Verstappen's problem, although he's not been able to finish a couple races this year, but if he has finished, he's been on the podium. Albon's finished races this year and just has not been able to really keep pace with his younger teammate. Because right now, Albon sits down in ninth place, and he has one podium finish, which was at the Tuscan Grand Prix this year. Otherwise, though, I mean, he's got 5 races this year where he hasn't scored. 4 of those he has finished. He finished 13th at the Austrian Grand Prix, finished 15th at the Italian Grand Prix, finished 12th at the Portuguese Grand Prix, and then 15th at the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, then retired at the Eiffel Grand Prix. So, unlike Max Verstappen, who has had 4 retirements as well this year, but again, when he's finishing races, except for the Turkish Grand Prix this past weekend, he's been on the podium. Turkey was the first time he finished a race and was not on the podium this year when he finished 6th. Otherwise, though, he's been right there, and of course, he has that win at the 70th anniversary Grand Prix. So if Max Verstappen's continued to be a contender for Red Bull, and that's the thing, when they had Vettel and Weber, when they had Vettel and Ricciardo, when they had Ricciardo and Verstappen, they had a duo that was always competitive. Even Daniel Kvyat, the first time he was with Red Bull as a part of the Red Bull team, teammates with Daniel Ricciardo, they still had a duo that would go out there and be competitive. But I feel like Webber-Vettel, Vettel-Ricciardo, Ricciardo-Verstappen, those three pairings for Red Bull have shown that they could put together a competitive duo. They just have missed the spot. I mean, Pierre Gasly, unfortunately, in the first half of last season, wasn't meeting the criteria, wasn't living up to the bar that Red Bull had set. So at the midway point, the summer break, they made the switch. They demoted Pierre Gasly back down to AlphaTauri. They promoted Alexander Albon for the remainder of that season. They gave him the chance this season. And I just don't feel like he's lived up to that Red Bull expectation. Because, again, he only has 1, 2, 3, 4. He only has 4 finishes in the top 5 this year. That's not the production that Red Bull needs to be competitive with the top team in Mercedes. And, again, they were the only team that could have challenged Mercedes this year after winter testing, seeing Ferrari just so far back and not seeing any kind of improvement either when they got to Austria for the season opening race. And there's been a little bit of improvement throughout this year. I mean, Vettel being on the podium in Turkey, definitely on a feel-good moment for him after the season that he's had. But knowing that Ferrari wasn't going to be there, it comes down to Red Bull being able to challenge Mercedes, and they just didn't do it. And you have to look at Albon down there in 9th place in the Drivers' Championship. So, and maybe it isn't a Red Bull driver. Sergio Perez out of his Racing Point contract after this season, after the next 3 races, maybe he's on his way to Red Bull. I think Nico Hülkenberg should have a seat in Formula 1. Maybe he's on his way to Red Bull. I mean, it could be either one of those two. Yuki Tsunoda, the very talented Formula 2 driver that's part of the Red Bull program. I mean, if he doesn't take the Red Bull seat, which may be a bit of a stretch, I could see him possibly taking the AlphaTauri seat and being Pierre Gasly's teammate next year, because I don't think Red Bull has been overly impressed with Daniel Kvyat this year either. So the fact that both of those seats are still up for grabs could be alluding to the fact that Red Bull is looking to lose Kvyat and possibly Albon for next year. So I could see Yuki Tsunoda maybe possibly taking that keep wanting to say seat or spot, and I've almost said sot like twice. So, but I could see Tsunoda taking that seat at AlphaTauri, being Pierre Gasly's teammate, then possibly having Sergio Perez or Nico Hülkenberg be the leading candidate for that Red Bull seat. And also talking about Red Bull, Honda, they announced this year that Honda, being the engine supplier for Red Bull and AlphaTauri, would be leaving Formula One after next season. So 2021 will be the last season that Red Bull and Honda partner, and that Honda's in Formula One at all. They may return again, like they did returning with Red Bull last year and this year, and next year, obviously. But Red Bull now, before the end of November, Christian Horner has said that he hopes to have the engine supplier figured out. So that may be priority number one for Red Bull right now. Deciding who's going to take the second seat at AlphaTauri and the second seat at Red Bull, it may be priority number one to figure out who their engine supplier is going to be for 2022. And once they get that figured out, then I imagine obviously they would go and figure out their driver lineup for next season as well. But, you know, could we be in a position for that? Because I think the fact that Sergio Perez, I mean, obviously he's missed some races due to some COVID diagnosis, or due to a COVID diagnosis, but I feel like when he's been in that car, he has been very, very competitive. And again, he was on the podium in Turkey. He was 2nd place in Turkey, only behind Lewis Hamilton. So, I mean, what a drive from Sergio Perez, who's also sitting 4th in the Drivers' Championship. Goes Hamilton, Bottas, Verstappen, and then Perez. So the fact that he's having that great of a season, I think he deserves to be in Formula One. And then Nico Hülkenberg, out of 21 drivers that have competed in the Formula One season this year, he's only finished 2 races, and he's 15th. He has scored more points in 2 races than 6 drivers have scored this whole freaking season. Nico Hülkenberg deserves to have a seat in Formula One next year, and it very well could be a Red Bull seat. So we'll see how that develops. But a lot to watch in terms of Red Bull, from their driver lineup, from AlphaTauri to Red Bull, as well as the announcements of their engine supplier for 2022, essentially moving forward from that season on. So a lot of interesting developments to watch there in terms of Red Bull and where they go for next season. And what's also interesting is that we know Haas is losing both of their drivers for next year. They've already confirmed that both Kevin Magnussen and Romain Grosjean will not be returning for Haas. So, of course, being a Ferrari-powered team, they were looking at guys like Mick Schumacher, Callum Ilott, Robert Schwartzman as young Ferrari Academy drivers that could possibly take. I mean, honestly, two out of the three of those guys could be driving for Haas next year. Or, again, they could choose one of those young guys. And I have a gut feeling that Mick Schumacher is going to have one of those two seats at Haas next season. But he could very well be paired with a Nico Hülkenberg or a Sergio Perez. So it'll be interesting to see what Haas does with their lineup next year. Was it going to be? It's either going to be, I feel like, two young Ferrari Academy drivers or one at Ferrari Academy driver and a seasoned vet like a Hülkenberg or Perez. That's the two ways I see Haas going with their driver lineup. I don't think they would do like a Hülkenberg and a Perez. Maybe they're looking for a little more experience over youth, but it feels like the youth movement's in full swing in Formula One right now. So I imagine one, if not both of those seats, will be taken by Formula Two Ferrari Academy drivers. So that'll be interesting to see where Haas... Speaking of those two Haas drivers for now, Romain Grosjean and Kevin Magnussen, both have confirmed that they have been in talks with some IndyCar teams. So they could very well find their way over to the United States for next season or possibly 2022 and be racing an IndyCar, which I feel like IndyCar is, I mean, compared to Formula One, obviously doesn't have that kind of international grand spectacle feel that Formula One does, you know, going all over the planet, typically going all over the planet. Obviously this year was a little different, but you look at last year, you look at next year, having the 22 races in 22 different countries, you know, not having that international feel, but in terms of competition, in terms of an equal playing field amongst drivers and cars, IndyCar I think is one of the toughest championships to win in auto sports. Not counting like endurance driving or anything like that, but in terms of like competing on paved racing circuits, whether it's a road course or an oval or whatever it is, I feel like IndyCar is one of the toughest championships to win because you have to be good on a speedway, you have to be good on a short track, you have to be good on a road course, and you have to be good on a street circuit. You have to be good on all four of those tracks to be able to win an IndyCar championship. So I think a lot of Formula One drivers, maybe, you know, like a Nico Hülkenberg or, again, a Sergio Perez, if they can't find a seat in Formula One, the same kind of two-driver-per-team restriction isn't a thing in IndyCar. You can have a team with four or five drivers and a team that has one driver. So possibly to get an influx of Formula One talent into IndyCar, I mean, you think about guys like Scott Dixon, Simon Pagenaud, Joseph Newgarden, Alexander Rossi locking up with, and some young guys in IndyCar like Felix Rosenquist, Patricio O'Ward, Colton Herta. You think about those guys locking up against guys like Romain Grosjean or Kevin Magnussen or Nico Hülkenberg. That could be a lot of fun. And I would not be disappointed at all if Magnussen and Grosjean found their way over to IndyCar. Maybe if Hülkenberg and Perez did as well. But I feel like one of those guys definitely going to be in Formula One next year. But yeah, that's where we kind of stand right now with some driver news. Still just kind of waiting to see what plays out. But looking forward to the end of this Formula One season. No race this weekend. But after this weekend, Formula One goes back to back to back to close out their season with the Bahrain Grand Prix and the Sakhir Grand Prix and the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix to end it all off. So it's nice not to have the end of the season dragged out. We know who the champions are now. So let's just get the rest of the season in. Let's enjoy these races. So the fact that after this weekend we can take a little bit of a breath and then get ready for the last three races, I'm all for that. And hats off to Formula One, all the racing leagues. Formula One, Formula E, NASCAR, IndyCar, IMSA, the WEC, all these guys for figuring out how to continue their season, crown a champion, do it safely. I know as a fan, I've really appreciated it. So I can't wait to see how this Formula One season comes to an end. But when we come back, we will take a look at the Mountain West scoreboard for the weekend. Also, some other fun college matchups, some obviously here on the West Coast as well. And we'll also take a look into the UFC card coming up this weekend. That's coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM. Another weekend of college football is upon us. And looking forward to it, especially should be a fun weekend in the Mountain West. Unfortunately, three games canceled on the Mountain West schedule for this week. There was supposed to be a game last night for the Mountain West between the winless Utah State Aggies and the 1-2 Cowboys of Wyoming. But that game did not happen. Two games canceled for tomorrow as well, that being UNLV at Colorado State. And then the undefeated San Jose State on the road against the 3-1 Fresno State Bulldogs. So those three games will not be happening this weekend for the Mountain West. But there's still three games that are going on for the Mountain West this weekend. 0-3 New Mexico takes on 1-2 Air Force, who is 0-2 in the Mountain West. That game going down tonight at 6:30. We'll see if New Mexico can get their first win of the season. And then two games happening tomorrow. So you have 3-1 Boise State and 2-2 Hawaii. But what may be the game of the week for, well, no, it's not maybe, what is the game of the week for the Mountain West? 3-1 San Diego State coming here to Reno to Mackey Stadium, take on 4-0 Nevada. And I mean, San Diego State Nevada is typically a huge game anyway. But the fact that you have Nevada that is playing so good this year, and again, talked about it all season long, but really the last two games, how much Carson Strong and Romeo Dubs are starting to connect. They've had six touchdowns in terms of Strong throwing to Dubs. That connection, six touchdowns in the last two games, three in each, and they just seem to be rolling so well. And Carson Strong, I feel like, has had that kind of feel to him all season long so far. It's weird to think that Nevada's already halfway through their season at 4-0. But they've just played so well. Their defense, I feel like they learned a lot from that fourth quarter against Wyoming. We haven't seen that kind of slip up from their defense since that fourth quarter. They've been rock solid since, and they continue to give their team a chance to win. And they've been coming up with big plays. When you have an offense like Nevada has this season, when your defense just come up with a few stops here and there throughout the game, and they're doing a lot more than that, but I mean, at the bare minimum, when you have a defense doing that with the offense you have, it already makes you so dangerous. But the fact their defense is coming up with major stops throughout these games, and you have the possibility of Carson Strong hitting Romeo Dubs from anywhere from 15 to 20 yards out to 50 to 60 yards out, that explodability is just unbelievable. And Nevada has won the last two games against San Diego State. 2018, when they played here in Reno, the last time they played here in Reno, Nevada won 28-24 over San Diego State. And then last year, going down to San Diego, Nevada won 17-13. So Nevada having won the last two games, San Diego State still leads the series 7-5. But Nevada the last two seasons has had San Diego State's number, and seeing what, again, they had some trouble against the New Mexico defense, which with the coaching staff has some connection there based on what we've seen from San Diego State in the past seasons. So I think Nevada having struggled a little bit against New Mexico last weekend, facing that kind of defensive scheme, will be better equipped to face a San Diego State this weekend, especially here at home. So I think things have lined up really nicely for Nevada. They've just been playing so, so well this season. They're a really fun team to watch on both sides of the ball. And I feel like this is going to be a really tightly contested game. The Aztecs, as of right now, looking at it on ESPN.com, is a 1.5 favorite on the road. But I think this is going to be a tightly contested game between both teams. I think Nevada obviously can get this done at home. They've seemed to be really balanced with their offense in terms of running and passing. Obviously, their passing game seems to have a little more pop to it this year than their run game, but still getting some really strong runs on the ground. And just excited to see what Nevada can do against the San Diego State team this weekend. So looking forward to that game, that 12:30 p.m. kickoff tomorrow. Of course, you can hear it right here on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM. Our pal John Ramey will be on the call. His broadcast partner, Mike Edwards, as well, will be there. So tune in to hear those two gentlemen call the game tomorrow from Mackey Stadium. Should be a lot of fun. I mean, it's again, like I said, it's usually a big marquee matchup when Nevada and San Diego State play. But the fact that you have an undefeated Nevada Wolfpack team and a 3-1 Aztec team, that should be, again, just a incredibly fun matchup to watch. And I strongly encourage you to listen to the game on ESPN Radio because Ramey and Edwards do a great job with the broadcast. But if you can't get to a radio, it is going to be broadcasted on CBS tomorrow. So watch it, listen to it, however you want to do it. But again, I recommend you listen to it here on ESPN Radio. But just enjoy the game tomorrow because I think it's going to be a classic between those two. And then another fun weekend shaping up in the Pac-12 as well. Chip Kelly's return to Autzen Stadium happens tomorrow as UCLA goes on the road to play number 11 Oregon, who has looked good. Tyler Shough for Oregon so far in two games, 38 for 56, 539 yards, and 5 touchdowns. It's not easy to replace someone like Justin Herbert, but Shough has done a good job so far in the first two games for Oregon, looking to see what he can do now against a Chip Kelly-coached UCLA team. I'm bummed that Autzen isn't going to be able to have fans there because it would have been a really nice change in demeanor, right? Chip Kelly kind of comes out onto the field pregame. Everyone gives him that nice standing ovation because of all the success that he had. But then as soon as that ball gets kicked off, he is the enemy. And I would have loved to have seen kind of the whole stadium just turn and get into game mode when that ball gets kicked off. But nonetheless, going to be fun to watch Oregon UCLA play tomorrow. USC 2-0, ranked 20th, will go on the road against Utah, who is having their first game of the season. So it'll be interesting to see how USC does on the road against a Utah team that is geared up to play two games but hasn't gotten to play either of them yet this season. So Utah will have their first game of the year tomorrow. And we also, I thought we had one other team playing their first game of the season, but I am mistaken because we did have two games get canceled for the Pac-12 this weekend. Arizona State at Colorado has been canceled, and then Washington State at Stanford has been canceled, and I have not heard of any kind of last-minute rescheduling of any of those two teams like they did last week with UCLA and Cal. So as of right now, two games canceled for the Pac-12, but the other games going on, California at Oregon State, Arizona at Washington, and then, of course, UCLA, Oregon, USC, Utah. So those four games for the Pac-12. Looking at some other fun top 25 matchups, number 3, Ohio State, number 9, Indiana there at the Horseshoe in Columbus, Ohio. Ohio State, 20.5-point favorites, but I'm not sleeping on this number 9 Indiana team. Not saying that they can get the win on the road, but they could test Ohio State nicely tomorrow in that game. Number 4, Clemson on the road against Florida State. Trevor Lawrence back, ready to go for the Clemson Tigers against the Florida State Seminoles. So we'll see how Clemson bounces back from their first loss of the year with Trevor Lawrence back under center. Number 6, Florida taking on Vanderbilt tomorrow. Number 7, Cincinnati, who has been one of the hotter teams in the country this season at 7-0, 5-0 in the conference, on the road against UCF. So a lot of fun top 25 games going down tomorrow. Fun game last night as well in the top 25. Number 25, Tulsa, survives Tulane in double overtime after being down 14-0 after 3. Tulsa scores 21 points in the fourth quarter to tie it up at 21. And then goes on to win it in double overtime. There was a Hail Mary in that game as well, very Kyler Murray-esque. Just a few days after Kyler Murray gets his Hail Mary, Tulsa gets one in that game as well. I believe it was Tulsa that got the Hail Mary there in that game as well. So Hail Marys all around, professional and collegiate football. But yes, Tulsa getting the 30-24 win over Tulane last night in that top 25 matchup. And then UFC back in action this weekend, another pay-per-view card, UFC 255, from the UFC Apex in Las Vegas. Two title fights tomorrow, which should be a fun main card. I mean, the main card gets started with a very well-known light heavyweight, Mauricio Shogun Rua, taking on Paul Craig. So that'll be a fun card to get a fun fight to get the main card started. Then Katlyn Chookagin and Cynthia Calvillo from the women's flyweight division. After that, Mike Perry missing weight for what was supposed to be his welterweight bout this weekend, but he will fight Tim Means in a catchweight fight. Then you have the two championship co-main events. Valentina Shevchenko defends her women's flyweight title against Jennifer Maia. And Jennifer Maia, she's 18-6-1, and looking at some of the other challengers that have come up to challenge for a UFC belt, I don't feel like a lot of them are 3-2 in their last five fights and just have a one-fight win streak. I don't feel like that's typically the case. But she did, in her last fight, beat Joanne Calderwood by a first-round submission via armbar. Did get her the performance of the night. So obviously got her enough attention to take on Valentina Shevchenko. But she has, Shevchenko that is, has the feeling of kind of a Silva in his prime. You're just not going to beat her. I mean, it seems like whoever she is matched up against, she is so good at identifying that weakness and then just picking it apart throughout the rounds. Whether she wants to end it in the second or the fourth or the fifth, it just feels like she is in total control when she is in that cage. And really, since she's joined the UFC, her only real hurdle that she hasn't been able to get over is Amanda Nunes. Those are her only two losses since joining the UFC, a unanimous decision to Nunes back in March of 2016, then a split decision loss to Nunes back in September of 2017. So other than the Lioness, no one's really been able to test Shevchenko, and I feel like that's going to continue this weekend. I feel like she defends her belt. Then the main event, the flyweight title. Devyson Figueiredo defends his title against Alex Perez. And again, Perez, an interesting opponent coming in on a three-fight win streak. Unanimous decision over Mark De La Rosa, then a technical submission over Jordan Espinoza, then he TKO'd Yair Formiga. So he's on a three-fight winning streak, finished the last two. He's 24-5 in his 29 fights so far. So somebody that's really gaining momentum. Then, of course, Devyson Figueiredo finally being able to win that flyweight championship after he defeated Joseph Benavidez in February of this year, but missed the weight limit, so was ineligible to actually win the championship. But then in a few months later, in July, got the technical submission with a rear naked choke and then was able to win the championship. So this is his first official title defense against Alex Perez, and I feel like Figueiredo has the upper hand in this fight, but not as clear to me as the women's flyweight matchup that precedes it. But looking forward to a fun fight card. Obviously some other great fights in the early preliminary card, but should be a fun main card tomorrow night for UFC 255. And that time has come, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, indeed.
The time has come. The sax man, Rick Metz, is here, and we will figure out what is on his mind coming up after the break. Not much. We'll talk to him after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM. It's that time on a Friday afternoon. Our pal, the sax man, Rick Metz.
Hello.
Joins us once more.
Hello. The Sax Man cometh, baby.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. You ready to talk some sports?
Always.
Lots of stuff going on,
there
baby.
Is.
We got to start on a sad note, unfortunately. The undefeated Miami Dolphins, 72 Miami Dolphins, have suffered another loss, unfortunately. Third this year. Started with
crazy.
Shula, Jim Kick. And now we've lost the legendary Jake Scott. Jake Scott passed away yesterday. He was a free safety. He also returned punts from 70 to 78 for the Dolphins and the Redskins. And he went to the Pro Bowl five consecutive times between 71 and 75. In his sixth season with the Dolphins, 35 interceptions.
Whoa.
Jake Scott was a major cog in the no-name defense. And he got another 14 in his 3 years with the Redskins, five-time All-Pro.
Crazy.
Now, safeties don't wear the number 13 anymore. Jake Scott wore number 13 for his entire career. And it was later made famous in Miami by Dan Marino.
There you go.
Dan Marino wore number 13. And that number's been retired for the Dolphins. in honor of Marino. But I really think Jake Scott should have had that number retired previously to Marino even being able to wear it.
That's
and
fair.
Marino probably could have bought the rights, and Jake Scott would have gotten a lot of money for that number. Yeah, but it was well deserved because he was bad luck to any offense that was facing him.
Yeah.
You know, and what's really kind of cool, I mean, I really dig the story of Jake Scott. He started his professional career in 1969 in the Canadian Football League. He was a flanker and a kick returner with the BC Lions. Now, you know, I've seen a ton of Canadian football.
I do know that.
Seen a ton of CFL when I played music up in Canada quite a bit. I got to see Flutie up there. I got to see all kinds of great players up there. I mean, I'm not that old that I got to see Jake Scott up there, you know.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. I'm old, but I'm not that old. Well, kind of. He was drafted by the Dolphins in the seventh round of the 1970 NFL draft.
Wow.
In his rookie year, he got five interceptions and returned one punt for a touchdown. That's pretty stellar for your rookie year.
Yeah, absolutely.
The following year, in his second year, seven interceptions and 318 punt return yards, and he helped the Dolphins reach Super Bowl VI, but they lost that 24-3 to the Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Cowboys had just come back from losing the Super Bowl a year before, mm-hmm. and they wanted that one big time, and they shut down the upstart Miami Dolphins. He had a 21-yard punt return in that Super Bowl, but in 1972... key member of the Dolphins' undefeated season, and helped take him to Super Bowl VII, and he was named the Super Bowl MVP.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. He got two interceptions in the game, with the Dolphins winning 14-7 over the Washington Redskins, who would later go on to play for, and he got one in the fourth quarter, which pretty much shut down the game. He also had, he helped the Dolphins in their Super Bowl VIII win because they won back-to-back.
Yep.
And he recorded two fumble recoveries. He got a 20-yard punt return and 47 kickoff return yards in that in Super Bowl VIII. He established two Super Bowl records. He was the very first player to recover two fumbles in one game. He also first established the record for most career fumble recoveries in Super Bowls at two. But that record's now shared by 12 others.
Jeez.
It's kind of funny when you think about it.
It
you
is.
Know, two fumble recoveries in a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And 13 people have done it. That's a big
there. That's a fair amount of people. I mean, we have had 50-plus games there, but still, I mean, two-plus fumbles.
But you know what's funny with those two fumble recoveries? One was of his opponent. The other one was a fumble recovery by his own team, which helped keep the Dolphins alive in that game. So he finished his nine seasons. He had 49 interceptions, 35 with Miami, and he's the Dolphins' all-time leader in interceptions. 13 fumble recoveries in his career. On special teams, he had 1,357 yards and a touchdown returning punts and 137 yards and only six kickoff returns. He played for the Redskins the final 3 years of his, career. And in the late 1980s, NFL Films gave him a really unique title. He named Jake Scott the Dolphins' all-time neutralizer.
Ooh.
Was sponsored by Tums. Thought you'd get a kick out of that.
That's fantastic.
I found that absolutely hilarious.
That's awesome.
Yep. Now, he was only one of three Dolphins, three living Super Bowl MVPs who did not attend Super Bowl 40, where all previous MVPs were honored prior to the game. You know who the other no-shows were?
I do not.
Bradshaw and Montana.
Interesting.
I have no idea why they didn't show up.
Yeah.
Yep. But he did attend Super Bowl 50 and was introduced during pregame festivities. You know, so he's also in the Miami Dolphins honor roll, and he was inducted there in 2010. And unfortunately, we just lost him yesterday. Rest in peace, Jake Scott.
Yes, Mr. Scott. Rest in peace.
Yep. I feel bad for the Miami Dolphins. He didn't get a chance to see that champagne get popped yet this year.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Pittsburgh's keeping him off just a little bit.
Mr. Morris's champagne is still chilling. If you don't know the reference, look it up, folks.
Yes.
Okay. If you're into sports as much as we are, we know that reference. So some unique stuff this last week in football and coming into this weekend. Coming into this weekend, it's the first time since 1966 that there's five matchups between teams with a .667 win percentage.
Oh, interesting.
Uh-huh. There's some good teams out there playing this weekend.
There
so
are.
It'll be an interesting weekend. Last night was a fun game.
Oh, man, wasn't that fun.
Seattle's defense went from being completely pitiful to just being okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was their best performance of the year. Not that that was saying a whole lot.
Carlos Dunlap stepped up. He was one of the best additions they could have made at this time of the year.
And having Carlos Hyde back as well in the run game.
Yep, that made a big difference for him as well. And, you know, Jamal Adams looked good. It looks like he's slowly recovering from that injury because he's still been a little hampered since he came back.
He has.
You know.
And speaking of injury, I mean, we have to wait to see the extent of Kyler Murray. I got so caught up in the opening segment of the show, forgot to mention that, but that happened early on in the first quarter.
It sure did.
Something with his throwing shoulder, so we'll have to wait and see what the full...
He looked like he's got, you know, something's going on there. We'll find out once they get all the medical tests done.
We will.
And Seattle's defense actually kind of shut down Kyler a little bit. Going into the game, he was the first quarterback with a rushing TD and a passing TD in five straight games since 1960.
Yeah, is that not crazy?
And you know who had that record in 1960? Tobin Rote.
Ooh, there's a name you don't hear too much
from
anymore.
History right there. Exactly.
Look at that.
Exactly. So this last weekend, Daniel Jones, the New York Football Giants, I think he has redeemed himself, even though his trip and fall from a few weeks ago will be indelibly linked to him for the rest of his life.
It will.
As a sign of his career follies in the early part. But he redeemed himself. He had a touchdown rush. It was the longest quarterback rushing TD for the New York Giants since 1991, Jeff Hostetler.
There you go.
Good old Haas. Got to see him play quite a bit when he came over to the Raiders near the end of his career.
Yeah?
Haas was still playing good at that time. Man. He just didn't have anything to work with.
Yeah.
You know.
But that will be, regardless of how well his career plays out, one of the first few highlights you'll see of his career tape is that stumble and fall.
That stumble and fall. But the next thing you'll see is the redemption, though, from this last weekend when he ran, you know, that long rushing TD. I mean, that was just beautiful. And he stayed on his feet.
I was
so happy for him. I really was. I was like, I'm thinking to myself, you know, deep down in the back of our brains, we're all looking at it going, go ahead, fall again.
Yeah.
Go ahead, do it again. Do it again. Come
let's see it. Come on.
Come on, do it again. Do it again. And he did it. And I was so happy for him. It was way cool. So last Monday on the 16th on Monday Night Football, Kirk Cousins redeems himself.
Mm-hmm.
Gets a win for his Minnesota Vikings, gets his first Monday Night Football win to bring his record on Monday Night Football to 1-9.
A whopping 1-9.
Hey, at least he got his win.
That's
because
true.
There were two big time quarterbacks that never won on Monday Night Football.
Mm.
Archie Manning and Joe Namath never won on Monday Night Football. They're both 0-8.
Surprised Namath even got a chance to play on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, well, no, Monday Night Football started in the early 70s.
I always forget that. I don't know why I feel like it always started in the 80s.
Nope.
I don't know why that's where I always get connected with it, but it did. It started all the way back in the 70s.
Back in the 70s.
Wow.
With Howard Cosell.
But wow, yeah, you wouldn't have. I mean, Archie Manning, that poor guy. I mean, the Saints gave him nothing to work with when he was there in New Orleans.
Absolutely nothing.
I mean, you want to talk about a talent wasted.
And I got to tell you, man, they were absolutely perfectly nicknamed at that time because they were most assuredly the Aints. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. But yeah, that's I mean, in one sense, I mean, kind of a cool group to be a part of just by the names. The stats a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah.
But if you phrased it correctly, say, hey, I share a same stat with Joe Namath and Archie Manning. So,
and if you stop right there,
exactly,
you're fine.
It sounds
but
good.
But you know, invariably, somebody's going to say, "Well, what stat is that, Kirk?" I hadn't won on Monday Night Football ever until last week.
Oh my goodness! Yes,
now,
but thankfully, he gets to avoid that.
Now I'm third on the list.
Yes,
futility for Monday Night Football. So,
oh man,
I want to talk about one of the biggest games coming up this weekend.
Okay.
Raiders.
Prime time.
Prime time, baby. The rematch against the Kansas City Chefs. Chiefs, sorry.
Yeah. Hey, don't have to apologize to me. I'm just happy for one time I'm not the source of the joking, the poking fun at.
Really? You don't want me to mention the Los Angeles Football Clippers?
Well, we had, Terry was on the show in the first hour. He almost said it twice.
Yeah.
He was, because he picked the Chargers to beat the Jets, but both times he mentioned it, he was like, oh, I almost said the Clippers. I was like, please don't. I get that enough from Rick.
Los Angeles Football Clippers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And if you guys don't beat the Jets this weekend, you will never hear the end of it.
Oh, it'll be an all-time low for this. I mean, it's been a rough season already, but should they lose at home to the Jets,
you
it'll be...
You guys are 8.5-point favorites to win at home against the winless New York Jets,
And
the odds makers are saying that you will actually win by more than one score.
I was going to say, you know what annoys me about that, though? 8.5.
Yeah.
Right around that one possession mark,
right,
which has haunted them.
But it's just over.
I know it's just over. But
you have a chance to redeem yourself.
It's close
if you
enough to where I don't feel comfortable about
it. If you cover, you're fine.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't, there you go again.
I mean, honestly, I just want to win for them.
Yeah.
But this is a good opportunity for a feel-good game to go out there and just try to pummel a team, but ultimately just get a win.
As a Raiders fan, though, there's only one thing I can say. Go Jets.
Yeah, I figured. I figured.
I had to.
Meanwhile,
I'm sorry,
for Sunday Night Football, I'll be hoping for a tie and many injuries.
Tie and many injuries. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now, it's the big rematch.
Yeah.
The Raiders beat the Chiefs in Week 5, 40-32.
At Arrowhead.
Mm-hmm. It's the first time we beat them in Arrowhead in like 8 years. And that was a stunning win for me. I went into that game thinking it's just going to be another Chiefs Raiders game, and you know, just like the other ones in the recent past,
the Mahomes era,
and even back into the Alex Smith era, the Andy Reid era.
That's the proper way to say it.
And we went in and we played a great game, and I'm looking forward to another great game. Although we do have some issues we're dealing with this week. 11 players on the COVID reserve list, but the one hopeful aspect of that is that only one player has tested positive and will not be playing for sure. That's Cleveland Farrell, our first-round pick from last year. And, Farrell has been playing well and gets better all the time, but he is not the main factor on that defensive line. We do have other great players that can go in and do the job for him. We got a good rotation.
Yeah.
Max Crosby is still doing great, leading the team in sacks. What we're looking at right now is all the other players that are on the COVID reserve list test negative throughout the week, and if they test negative tomorrow on Saturday, they're all eligible to play on Sunday. Unfortunately, no practice time, everything virtual, but the NFL has gone into the intensive COVID protocols
for everybody,
making it even more difficult to get prepared for every game coming up through the rest of the season. But they should have done that since the beginning of the season, in my
that's
humble
what I was
opinion.
Saying. Yes, that's what I was that's what I was saying as well. You shouldn't have waited till now to put people into intensive protocols. That should
it
have
should
been
have
the protocol
happened
from
right
the
away, so they all got used to it.
Yeah,
and they got used to doing that every week because football players and professional athletes, needless to say, are creatures of habit. They get used to their routine, no matter what that routine is.
Absolutely. We got about a minute and a half left here, and what I wanted to say, I'll ask you one question here real quick, but what I wanted to say is I will not doubt John Gruden in divisional games because he seems to get his team pumped up more than any other game. They're 3-0 so far in the division.
True that.
So I even though Kansas City's coming off a bye, they're looking for revenge, there's some COVID, possibly some issues for the Raiders. It's a divisional game. They have not lost in the division yet this year.
They're playing some good football.
What do you think the score is going to be for the game on Sunday night?
Oh, goodness. You're asking me for a score? I haven't even considered a score
yet. I don't necessarily...
I'm still dwelling on the victory lap from the previous win.
I don't necessarily... How about this? I don't necessarily need an actual score, but margin.
Raiders by 3.5.
Okay.
I'm putting the Raiders. We're now a 7-point dog at home, according to the odds makers. Opened as a 6.5-point dog. I'm putting us as a 3.5-point favorite at home against the Kansas City Chiefs.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. I know you are, too. So we'll see how it goes. He is the Sax Man, Rick Metz. We will be back to close out the Spencer Wilson Show after this on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM. Welcome back to the show. Big thank you to our pal Saxman Rick Metz for coming in here. Big thank you to our pal Terry for joining us as well. Yes, you heard it there at the end of that commercial break, but do not forget Nevada, San Diego State tomorrow. Major, major matchup in the Mountain West. 4-0 against 3-1. And as you heard there in the commercial, 11:30 is when the pregame show will start here on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM. 12:30 is the kickoff. So tune in for the pregame at 11:30. Stick around for the kickoff at 12:30. Listen to John Ramey and Mike Edwards call the game. They do a great job with it. Fun to watch and listen to this team this year. And it should be. I got a feeling it's going to be a classic against the Aztecs. So enjoy Nevada's game tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of college football tomorrow. The UFC, if you're going to watch that, enjoy it. If you're going to watch, I mean, obviously the NFL on Sunday, enjoy that. Major League Soccer playoffs also kick off here in about 30 minutes. So whatever you're going to watch this weekend, enjoy it. Be safe. And yeah, let's just enjoy what is a great weekend of sports. Weird not to have any racing on, but that'll be solved next weekend. But have a safe weekend. I'll talk to you guys on Monday. Peace.